Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Circus Podcast, episode 111.
Etundra Elva. That's Swedish. Happy past Halloween.
Ooh.
Yeah, we were Mommy Pig, Daddy Pig, and George Pig from a British little kids cartoon show, Peppa Pig. So if you are not familiar, you can look it up.
If you're not familiar, you're really missing out.
Well, if you're not familiar, you probably don't have kids.
No, our son Cyrus, who's about to turn 16 months old now, this is his first trick-or-treating where he was like walking around grabbing candy out of baskets, although not sure he understood what he was doing, but he did successfully grab the candy.
No, but he and his friend Jack had fun, and so did we, and now we are on to November, which is just crazy.
Yeah, Christmas is right around the corner.
Yeah, and thinking about where we only have 3 weeks left to Babel, which is also crazy.
Oh, man.
And the thing, we started load in for Babel, Beyond Babel, which is our dance show off Broadway.
In January of 2020?
January. Well, really, December of 2019, we started doing like actual work on it to get it ready to load in. And then January 2020, we loaded in the theater.
So nearly 2 years later.
Yeah. And, we have at this venue, which is like not common for a lot of theaters, you prepay your rent versus paying weekly, which is a lot upfront for a production, but
there's pros and cons to it.
Pros and cons. One of the pros, though, was that we had, well, or con, depending on how you look at it, we prepaid for 2 months of rent that were canceled because of COVID. So these were kind of our 2 months back plus a few weeks. So we ended up having a longer run than we were originally thinking. So that's a real positive and a blessing that we were able to come back and continue and finish out what we had originally started.
Yeah, 3 weeks left of this sort of 8 week long restart. And I mean, definitely if you want to come the last week, now is the time to buy your tickets because the last week is already filling up. But it's kind of sad in a way because, it's so much work for both of us. But also it kind of feels right. Like the show, we never thought the show would still be playing off Broadway at the end of 2021. So the fact that it's still going and that we were able to bring the show back, bring audiences back, provide all the work for these dancers, and now set it up for a national tour in the next year or so.
Yes, mixed feelings. Excited to move on to the next phase of its life because it does feel like it's been stuck in limbo for so long. But sad to not have it playing in New York where we can just hop on the subway and go watch it. So pros and cons, but pro is we're back. We made it back. A lot of shows didn't. And then we have a tour to look forward to, which we will have more details soon.
Yeah. So for those of you who can't come to New York and, live in another state or can't travel, don't worry. We'll probably be coming to you. One of the very interesting trends that we talked about a little bit when we were talking about the Stars Above Our Circus show is everybody waiting until last minute to buy their ticket, which is still very much the case for Beyond Babel. And it's funny now that Broadway shows have started to reopen and new ones are opening every single week, seeing how this is sort of affecting the larger New York ecosystem. So this seems to be here to stay for a while, where shows don't build this big advance. They sell everything basically a week or 2 weeks beforehand. And now Broadway is pushing out weekly updates on how everything is doing, as opposed to, I guess they were always weekly, but in this case, they're aggregates. So you don't get to see how each individual show is doing. You only get to see how all of the shows in total are doing. And they're doing what looks like about 60 to 65% as well as they did this week in 2019. But what's misleading about that is that means that some shows are doing normal, probably like Wicked and Hamilton, and a lot of other shows are doing really badly.
They're, the Broadway League is all excited because they're like, we have 85% capacity at our shows, aggregate.
With fewer shows.
With fewer shows. And so if you have Six, the musical, Hamilton, Wicked, that's at running at 80%, 85%, whatever. Of course, it's going to look better than reporting each individual show. So they're smart to do it like that because look how Broadway is back, like blah, blah, blah. But when you go into individual shows and look at the seating charts to buy a ticket, you can really see that the aggregate is not the all.
No, certainly when you average everything out, you essentially lose a lot of the detail. And, you know, one of the ways to figure out what's going on is to go and see shows off Broadway and on Broadway. And besides our own, we've actually seen a few recently. Last week, we went to go see Caroline or Change. The week before that, you saw Jagged Little Pill. Maybe 2.5 weeks before that, we saw Freestyle Love Supreme. So, you know, we're putting our butts in seats and showing up for these shows. But I gotta say, I think it does not feel like how it used to feel when we're in these theaters. Like, both the experience of getting in the theater and the energy in the room, as well as the way audiences are reacting to different things in different shows, seems different. I don't know a better word than different.
Yeah. Starting at the beginning, the customer experience to get into the theater is pretty bad, because now they have COVID checks where you have to show your vaccination card and your ID. Then you go through the metal detector and then you get your ticket and you go in, and the line to do the COVID test, vaccination check, it was so long. And when I saw Jagged Little Pill, we arrived like a half an hour before, and I don't think we got into the theater till curtain. And I was like, they're going to be holding, because there was a huge line behind us. So I wouldn't say it's the best experience. And then, you know, you're packed in like a sardine waiting for the bathroom, running to the bathroom. So I don't know. It's not a nice experience. And it was never a nice experience. Those two things, the bathroom lines and the getting in lines, makes it even worse now with your mask. And the audiences, they're clapping at weird places. And I don't know if they always have, and it's just been a year and a half and we forgot.
Yeah, audiences, I do think they are reacting differently than how they used to react. In one of the shows we saw, there's a character who's meant to be 49 years old, who's having a conversation with an 8-year-old on stage. It's a 49-year-old black woman and an 8-year-old Jewish boy. And he says something racist, and then she says something anti-Semitic, and then like half the audience applauded at them, you know, having this horrible interaction, almost like power to you for saying these horrible things. And similarly, when we saw another show, Freestyle Love Supreme, the audience, rather than clapping, was silent at moments where I thought clapping would happen, or at least it didn't feel like they were so uncomfortable. So I don't know. I think every show we've been to, I've been kind of surprised with audience reactions.
You know, I think like with Jagged Little Pill, there's a lot of virtue signaling, I guess. That's the only way to really put it, where it's very generic statements. Generic statements about social issues. And first of all, I feel like you're in a Broadway house, so the audience coming to see your show is already pretty probably in line with the beliefs that are being said in the show. So you're preaching to a room full of people who most likely already believe what you're preaching. But you're doing it with signs, protesting signs. And then you as an audience member feel like you have to clap at every single sign that gets held up, or else it looks like you don't believe it. And that's, it felt like very forced clapping in Jagged Little Pill, where it was like, oh, I should clap because if I don't, my neighbor might think I don't believe in this statement that this sign is making. And I do feel like that's a little bit of it. It's like this pressure to like, yeah, like I believe that too. Like you get it. The audiences are weird. But honestly, they've been weirdly clapping in Babel too, our dance show. Like there's a scene where two people get, basically, the whole show is about like division, right? And people get a red cuff or a blue cuff, and they divide people. And then there's a wall that gets built through this town and divides the town. And some people get blue, some people get red bands. And then in one scene, there's these two characters that you care about, that one gets red and one gets blue. And it's a really sad moment. And the audience clapped. I was like, why are they clapping? Like, this isn't, what are they clapping for? Are they clapping because they think the scene's over?
The dancing was
good. Like, what are you clapping for? And I think that's like, that's the question that I've continually had as we see shows. Why are you clapping? Like, it's very bizarre.
Well, using clapping as a segue, I'll give a little round of applause for Spiegelworld, who Ross Mollison's the founder of the company. He's been on the podcast multiple times. They just announced a $75 million deal to make 3 new shows and 3 new venues with Caesars Casinos in Vegas, Atlantic City, and New Orleans. That's something I'm a little bit more excited about seeing, because no one's clapping for virtue signaling in a Spiegelworld show. They're clapping for great acrobatics and probably dirty jokes.
Yeah, which, yeah, it's a bit more fun. Yeah, I'm super excited to see what they do. I love Spiegelworld. They have such a strong point of view and a voice, which is important because they never really seem like anyone else, which I think is hard to do today because so many people just copy other people. And I always love watching their shows because it's a distinct character, a distinct vibe, a distinct voice. So I can only imagine, you know, with $75 million, what awesome things they can cook up. And I know there's one that is like a disco theme with Stephen Hawking.
Yeah, I think it's with Stephen Hawking.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know
if we're saying that out of turn. I'm sure it's on the internet somewhere, but it's at The Link, which is a relatively new or rebranded casino in Vegas. And then I saw the one in Atlantic City. They're taking over a theater on the boardwalk that's existed for maybe since the 1920s or 30s, and they're renaming it the Spiegelworld Theater. And then in New Orleans, I guess Caesars Entertainment is doing a big $100 million, multi-million-dollar renovation. So no word yet necessarily on what those two shows will be. The other two, the one in Atlantic City and New Orleans. But I can at least imagine some themes you might go with Atlantic City.
Yeah, I can imagine it too. And they opened up a restaurant also in Vegas, which
Super
we have to
frigo.
Go see. I mean, everything is so much harder now with a baby. Before, we could be like, okay, let's go to Vegas this weekend. It's so easy. We can just take the night flight, get there, you know, and then take the first flight back, whatever. Now it's like, okay, when can we fly? Who's going to watch him? How much can we bring? So much more of a production. So I do actually reminisce about our last trip. Vegas was the last trip we took pre-baby, pre-COVID.
Wow.
I know. And I can't wait to go back. We have so much new to see.
We do. And in this case, we can also make a trip down south if we want to see today's guest. Speaking of traveling and going and seeing shows, Kevin Vernardos is a former actor turned circus ringmaster turned circus producer and director. He's been taking his big top tented show on a tour all over the U.S., including Colorado and Florida. And it's a really neat company that kind of reminds me of, honestly, what we were doing this summer and also what Blaze Burge does with Flint Creek Circus, where it's a relatively small group of performers who do it all. They set the show up. They, in this case, they even sell concessions and do ticketing and then do a crazy act or multiple crazy acts. Our friends Jan and Ari, who Ari does a wire walking number and Jan does Rolla Bola, are both in the show at the moment, and I've been just loving watching them and their family on Instagram.
Oh, they're on the show.
Yeah, they're on Vernardo's at the moment.
Oh, I didn't know that. With the kids?
With the kids. One of the things that Kevin talks about is how on his production he likes to start people out with relatively short contracts to see if they're a good fit in the vibe.
Good foot.
And Jan and Ari are on tour with them right now.
That's awesome. Oh my gosh, their kids are so cute. They came to see our circus show this summer, Stars Above, and they were front row. And I remember asking Ari, because they saw the very first show, I think. I was like, you know, their kids are young. And I was like, was this too adult? Like, theme? How did you feel as a parent? She's like, no, it's great. I mean, you didn't talk about anything too dark. And you have to talk about it somehow with your kids. So having them exposed to more adult themes at a young age is nice. And I was like, oh, phew. I'm happy with that answer. I don't know if I think she meant it, but but their kids are really cute. So we got to go see. But this interview was nice because I think he's one of those people that are just so genuinely excited to be doing what he's doing and feels very blessed to be doing it. And that definitely comes across in every single one of his answers and the gratitude that he feels to be in the position he's in. And I didn't know much about him or Vernardo Circus. You know, I knew like bits and bobs from just people being in the show or, you know, having heard him on ACA calls, American Circus Alliance. But it was really nice to get to know him and hear his story.
Yeah, I'm excited for folks to hear this. It honestly reminds me of something that Chris Lashua, who started Cirque Mechanics, said, which is that there's no other way to do it than to grind it out and really do it all yourself. And Kevin is proof in the pudding. Is that how you say that? Kevin is proof that that is the case.
Proof in the pudding.
I don't know. My point is...
That's a weird saying when you actually think about it.
My point is Kevin is clearly a super hardworking dude who's following his dreams, and it seems to be paying off. So I think for those of you who are interested in what it takes to start a circus and also what it takes to go from being a performer to a producer, this is an episode for you.
After listening to the interview, which I'm sure you're going to love, and I'm sure you already love our podcast, so make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter tweet us, or email us at hello@howtobecircus.com. We also have a special announcement coming up next week, so stay tuned.
Stay tuned for that announcement, and don't forget, Beyond Babel, 3 weeks left in New York City. Get your tickets, beyondbabelshow.com.
And without further ado, here is our interview with Kevin Vernardos. Is that a good announcer voice? Kevin Vernardos! I could not be a ringmaster.
Kevin, thank you so much for doing the show. I'm so pumped to talk to you. I've been enjoying following your circus on Instagram all summer. Where are you guys at the moment?
Hi, Josh. Thanks for talking with me. It's a pleasure. Right now, I am looking at the tent setup. We're in Huntsville, Alabama. We're nearing the end of a two-week engagement, and it's been another awesome visit to this. This is the second time we're actually here. The first time was February 2020, and a week later, we had arrived in Shreveport, Louisiana, and the show got shut down because of all the things that you know well about. And so it's been marvelous to be here, because many of the people who came to see us last time we were here, they've come back. And I mentioned in the show what I just told you, and all of the folks in the audience, of course, have a point of reference to that time, that demarcation moment, and all of the stuff that's happened in our lives since then. And kind of this full circle. I know we're not entirely out of the swirling dark clouds yet, but it's working and people are coming to the show, and I feel like we are alive again. And that's a wonderful feeling for myself, for the folks here on the show with us, their families, and also really for these people who are coming to enjoy it. That makes me really hopeful about things to look forward to.
So when you're not on the road, where do you call home?
I really don't have a home. I mean, the company's in Florida because California, where we started, asks for a lot of stupid taxes. So it made sense for us to move the company to Florida, and also circus. And I mean, we have a lot of dates like St. Augustine that have been kind of anchor points of our tour. So it made sense in some logistical points, but really we don't have a physical location. We have done all of this circus building really from the road, from various RV parks or campgrounds or fairgrounds or rest areas, over the last, really the first Vernardo Circus was a tiny outdoor 30-minute show done 4 or 5 times a day at the LA County Fair back in 2014, all with rented or borrowed equipment. And today we have a circus, and most of the equipment is all paid off. And we have, most of all, relationships with a bunch of incredible communities. If you get a community to believe in what you do, and you're able to get through all the slings and arrows of actually getting back to them again for a period of years, and you start to turn your event into what becomes a tradition, there is no stopping something like that. And I think that is really, America is just a collection of communities. We have, I mean, when there's not the fallout from the pandemic, which is causing a lot of disruption in supply chain and goods, but we have an amazing supply chain. We have a lot of amazing parts of the country, but they're really at the core, what I believe is, it's just a patchwork of communities. And if you can mean something and serve an individual community, and do it again and again, they will show up for you. And that's how I see the future and the sustainable factor of the circus, in addition to watching how much we spend and then finding the right people for whom the bandwidth I have can provide value, both in terms of just money and then also the experience and that moment in their life where they happen to be, the timing of things. I think that if I continue to nurture that community here on the road, and I can ask multiple things of individual people, which what I do now, you know, everyone sets up the tent. Everybody is a performer, they perform, but really it's a group of 15 people that does literally everything. But to make that a sustainable endeavor for those people, they need to feel like they're respected, that they're valued, and that they're part of something special. So there's a lot of plates to spin there, to use a circus metaphor. But I think that we have now a track record, and we have a tour. And I'm so grateful to be out there. And even with all the challenges and a lot of variation in how people, these communities, have processed what has happened in the last couple of years here, how they feel the politics and laws or restrictions, how that manifests in terms of restrictions. That means that we need to listen to and be aware of the community that we're coming into here. And so that's not an exactly easy task. It's not a science. It's a very breathing thing. As certainly as we dip our toes into places we haven't been back to now that the pandemic is where it is. So I'm not sure where I am going now with this. This is now just a series of observations.
I definitely want to get, you know, a good amount of the story of the growth from that LA festival to now. But before we get there, I'd love to get some biography bits in. So where did you grow up? Did you see circus as a kid? Was that your interest or was something else your passion?
Well, I did not have any kind of really circus background. I don't come from a circus family. My dad was a TV producer who worked with Walter Cronkite and later was the executive producer of the evening news during the 80s when Dan Rather were there. And so as a little kid, I went into the studio with my father there on the west side of Manhattan, and I looked up in awe at all these amazing things my dad was doing. He was my hero. He's definitely a figure who even now I think about all the time. We built model trains together. I actually talk about that in my show. But I did not come from a background of a performing family or anything like that. No, I was weird in that way. So I did, you know, the plays and musicals in high school. And really, I followed, because I was so close in New Jersey where I grew up, to Broadway. They took me to shows and I loved Broadway shows. I loved the way that music and storytelling happened in them. So that's what I did. I went to college and at Ithaca and I studied musical theater. And I came back to New York and I tried to get jobs. And I did everything that I auditioned for, everything that anyone would pay me money to do. I sang at High Holy Services in Brooklyn, and I'm not even Jewish. But of course, growing up in New Jersey means you're either Jewish or you're Italian or some other of the milieu of diversity that exists in that world. But those are my peeps, you know, Northern New Jersey. So I do miss bagels anyways, getting off topic, that's where I grew up. I love Broadway. So it was totally a left turn when I got, at 22 years of age, I got a job with the Ringling Brothers Circus as the ringmaster, which was an absolutely astonishing experience and odyssey that spent 5 years and three different productions. And it was amazing. It was a totally different, you know, the circuses and circus families and small shows. What I'm doing now is a mud show, technically speaking, although it has aspirations of being a theatrical event. The fact is, it's a small tent and we all put it up. On Ringling, I did no physical labor whatsoever. I sang and danced for, you know, 10 to 13 shows a week. And I thought I had really, really worked my butt off. And then I went to Whole Foods and got cheese and wine and stocked the larder in my train car. And I did that for 5 years. And I may be painting a slightly facetious picture here. There was a lot of it's being on the road is tough, and but it was an amazing experience. It certainly was seminal in that, you know, after that, circus has been part of my life. Now there was
Kevin, just on Ringling. What was that audition like? Did you go in knowing what you were auditioning for? And then when you got it and you were doing it the first season, were you like, what is going on? Or like, what was that reaction, just the introduction to it?
Well, they had actually hired a casting director who was actually working inside of the City Court building in Manhattan. There's a theater down below, and they did these musicals in Mufti, the York Theater. I don't know if you've ever heard of the York Theater. I haven't heard about what they're doing since then, but it existed at the time. And the casting director, I happened to be passing the hallway one day. He's like, hey, you're tall. Give me your headshot and resume. So he slid it into the pile. And when I went in, I sang Giants in the Sky from Into the Woods. And I love that song. And I read some Ringmaster copy. You know, the ladies and gentlemen stuff. And I always did. My dad, who started in radio and always had this booming voice, he had this whole speech that he would do. But, you know, I remember you guys grew up near in the New York area. So like, remember the monster truck commercials, like Saturday, Saturday, Saturday and Sunday too. It's monster truck, Truckzilla, Bigfoot. We'll sell you the whole seat, but you'll only need the edge. I think I'm drawing that actually from
my God, that's so good.
Simpsons. I think that was actually on The Simpsons, but I know those voices because I grew up with those voices on the radio. So doing the ladies and gentlemen, which is what the kind of world that they wanted, which, you know, it fit. And I had that in my imagination mind, but it definitely carried me through those 5 years and so much adventure. And I was very young. So but certainly as time went on and I got to other shows, I had to learn a lot to like just talk with people instead of, you know, it's imagine being at a table with your family and people you know, or people you care about, and saying, would you please pass the salt? And it's just like, yo, just easy. You know, are you trying to blow us away or are you trying to draw us into something? So I'm again getting off topic, but that's really what happened. And that's how I got the audition and got the job. I can't explain why they hired me. But I probably because I fit the costume that a gentleman named Michael McGowan, who had done it for a year at that time and went on to do a bunch of Broadway shows, The Producers and so many other things. Hi, Michael, if you ever hear this, you're amazing. Anyway, so that's how it went. And that gig did end in 2005 after a few contracts. And I there was a protracted period of wandering after that and making stupid moves. There was a marriage and a divorce. There was buying a house and trying to short sell the house. And after 2 years in Vegas, I bought this house as soon as I finished Ringling. And within 2 years, it was worth half of what I had paid for it. And I put down 20%, like you do, and all the money that I'd saved my Ringling years. So that started a spiral of depression, which ultimately led to filing for bankruptcy. And life being a complete disaster. And so in 2011, my dad, who was my hero, he passed away. And so that leads to 2014, where I had for a time between dad passing and the first Venardos produced event, I had sold all of the contents of my trailer on Craigslist. Individually, a piece of time to pay rent and stuff like that. Then I sold the trailer, and for a time I was living inside the truck. And then I sold the truck, and by then I, on terrible terms, I financed a very uncomfortable Kia Sportage. I was living in the San Fernando Valley in a terrible walk-up apartment that, when during a rainstorm, giant funnels of water started buckling through the popcorn ceiling, and years later, I actually watched that show, The Greatest Showman, the movie, and there's a scene where water's coming in his ceiling, and I was just crying in the theater, because this is what it was. And I can't say that I am a victim of anything but wonderful family, wonderful opportunities. I went to college. Anything that I really wanted to do, I have done. I think that one of the big lessons is that when reality is changing around me, I cannot just keep doing the same thing that I always did and expect a different result. And so I'm grateful now that that's behind me, but I'm also grateful for what I learned about money, about adjusting to and making plans for the future and being a part of the future to define my goals and dreams and not just have them be a nebulous. Yeah, I want to be in shows. I want to do the best I can. Now, if you want to make a dream come true, you have to make a very specific dream down to the serial number. And only then can you make a roadmap, or you can measure if you're making any progress toward that dream and if you've actually accomplished it. So certainly you adjust the dream along the way and reality keeps changing like a COVID, blah, blah, blah. But I'm so grateful for the struggles because this has given me a gratitude that I would never have been able to have honed or developed. So I hope to bring that gratitude to what I do, and especially the people who make the circus happen. They are, and the tent and the stuff is absolutely worthless. It is a pile of crap that just costs money and does nothing. All of it are the people who make it happen. So I think that my personal experiences, I believe equipped me to put them first. And when I do that, especially because it's a small, the tent seats about 400 people, it's packed. But we're working the front door. We take tickets. We usher people to the seats. If we have to jump on the line and make snow cones, that's what we do. So if people who have worked hard all week to earn their sawbucks to show up with their kids, they see someone at the front, you know, who's taking tickets, who's really in a pissy mood, who got shat on because of this experience, or they're arguing with this thing, or they don't feel valued and appreciated, the guest absolutely feels that. And that sucks joy away from their experience. So I really do see a connection to my bottom line, the bottom line of the circus, in terms of the happiness overall. I know it's not going to be roses every single day, but that communication is taking place, that we, as fundamentally wish to deliver something excellent and to support each other along that endeavor. Communication is the biggest part of that for me. So I keep going off into totally wild directions here. You haven't reeled me in. So
I mean, we'll cut you off if it's too wild. We're enjoying it.
Well, okay, I was listening, to when you're like 27-ish, when you're done with Ringling. And theme that we've been hearing over this past 2 years of COVID, a year and a half, whatever, is like the, when a performer no longer has the audience, because the high that they get from the audience reaction to them. And then what do you do with that mentally when it's not there? And I wonder if that was also what you were feeling when you're, 27 at such like a pivotal moment of your life, and you no longer have this like audience high, essentially, and it's kind of interesting that that happened to you.
I'm sure there's part of that. And there certainly was a high from, I got to perform in front of like 35 million people, I think, in the 5 years that I was there, which seems absolutely astounding. But it's a very different kind of experience than the one that I have had in a much smaller environment with fewer people. And the intensity of the emotional connection is much more fulfilling. And there are different experiences, and they're both marvelous in their ways. But and also perhaps because it's been my journey now that I own it. I think that there's something more, though, than just the audience thing. It was a desire to be somehow more in charge of my life and less at the mercy of a contract being renewed. I think the whole notion of an audition is, it's a lot of crap. It's a flawed thing. It is true that I look at reels and I need to see a video or see someone perform before I can see, maybe make a decision about bringing them on as part of a team. So that won't really end. It's still the best that we have, but I still think conceptually it's just totally flawed, because you don't have to prove anything to other people. And when you're still struggling in the beginning, or when you're without work and you need work, it changes entirely the dynamic of you know, sharing and giving, because it comes from a place of fear and the need to prove yourself to someone else. And what I have learned now is that the less that I think about things in terms of working for someone else and more in terms of how can I provide value to others, it's much easier now that there's some kind of structure and some few pieces of equipment and some momentum to the dream. And in the beginning, it's much harder. You're one lone idiot with this flag in the sand saying, I'm going to do this thing. And, you know, it's really hard when no one else is really believing in that the way that you are. So I guess all I could say to get past that is just keep doing it and keep trying things and putting, you know, don't worry, be crappy. The idea that you have to make something that's perfect at the gate is false. Much more about connecting with others and providing value to others, not being perfect. Anyways.
So I'm curious, at this point where you're making the realization that you kind of want to be a bit more in control of your destiny and you're having these ideas to have your own show, what's the show in your mind? I know the tagline, at least that I've seen, is the American circus with the heart of a Broadway show. But what was in your mind, and what do you think is kind of the identity of the company?
Well, I had been working with Circus Vargas in 20... Well, let's see. Circus Vargas was the third show. I did Ringling, and then a couple of years wandering, and then I got a gig on Big Apple for a couple of years, and then Circus Vargas. This takes us to about the end of 2012. And while I was there in Vargas, I was just thinking, where am I going to go after this? How many circuses are there out there where I can be the ringmaster? There's just really not. I love the singing and the storytelling, that Broadway aspect of things. That's what, like I said, I grew up near Broadway. So that was what attracted me to the Ringling audition in the first place. And I wanted to keep finding a way to keep doing that. It really came initially from a very selfish place of wanting to keep doing the thing that I wanted to do. And over the course of Vargas, I got the chance to put a couple of different scores together with an incredibly talented composer, Larry Lees. And we built two different musical scores with a big opening number, big finale, and some interstitial pieces. So I got to be part of the project management of working with musicians, or, you know, he would write the score and would talk about shape and form. Anyways, doing that was empowering. And I said, you know, if I have an idea for a thing, if I just find the money to do it, that we could put a score together. And this is fabulous stuff, Larry. So while I was still on the second year of Vargas, I started by, we made some music, me and Larry. I'm like, I have this thing that I want to do. So it started with the production number, an opening number, a finale, some little tags at the end of the first half. I saw it in two halves. It's got to be an intermission if it's going to be a show. You know, I know that I'm pulling things from different things that I've seen in other shows. But we're all can't help but be influenced by the world and the things we see. I don't think that that's stealing. I think that you take the best parts and you find what works for you and you make
There's
them better. You lift them.
There's a quote that's like, art is just taking the best thing of everyone else.
Stealing is when you take like one thing from one person, and like art is when you take like a lot of things from like 100 people or something like that. You know.
All right. Well, then I definitely am doing art then. So by this time, we made a score, we recorded it. And what I did was I made a video, a 1 minute and 16 second video with a little piece of music. And I rented a tent in Riverside, California, and convinced a bunch of performers to basically shoot a little Broadway circus video of a circus that I did not own. And nothing in there did I own. In fact, I would be screaming in the years after that I should have spent the money I spent on the video and on the music on things like gas and food. I'm grateful now that I might have done things different looking back, but I'm grateful that I did them this way. And we used that video to basically pitch this notion of a circus to, you know, I was aiming high. I don't know who would take it. I thought it was going to be corporate events. That's really was the initial thing, because they got the cash, they can spend it, and then maybe I can use that money to do more things. Well, I ended up pitching that thing to so many people, and corporate people, well, from my experience, they don't really know what they want. And often by the time you get busy and have done all this work on presenting some sort of creative presentation to them, they've moved on to something else, or they don't even know when they have something awesome right in front of their nose. So a lot of those no's, like as opposed to yes, were definitely fuel for me to say, like, screw you people, this is a good circus idea. I'm going to find a way to do this. So I was still banging the event drum when I landed the circus for the LA County Fair. And that was, after doing, Madison Square Garden and, with the Top Hat and opening night party and a star in this subculture, which is the circus. I don't think the circus should be a subculture. I think it should be mainstream. I think that, well, we can talk about that later. I think recognition for the circus should be mainstream. Anyways, that's another thing. So there I was in Pomona, California in late August with a tiny little tent, this 10 by 20 tent. And we used as sort of a place where the artists would hide while the show was going on, and they would come out through the portal and do their thing in a wooden ring that we placed on the ground. Audience members were, it was just a giant hallway that's open air, and people would lean over a steel rail to watch our 30-minute show. This is really the highest of quality experiences for our guests. I mean, it's the fair, and people expect it, and they love it. It's just a tradition. So we did our thing in 120-degree heat, often in the sun, with outdoor show. And it worked. It definitely, the way that people reacted to this very simple, I think six people, we did and then just a little opening, a little finale number, 30 minutes, very tight. Everyone did one thing. That's all there was time for. And we did that 4 or 5 times a day until we, our hands are bloody and our faces are completely red from the sun. But I really loved the even though I was out there, pulling the lines, doing all these things that I had never done before, never been asked to do on another show. It was somehow just, I loved every second because we made it happen, this little group and us. And so all of those challenges and naysayers and those voices, it made each little task that might've been laborious under a different lens, just joyful. So we did that. And then, by the next year we had added the LA County Fair House is back. We added another one. It was like the Greater Gulf State Fair. So here I was, I had two fairs. One is in California, another one's in Alabama. And I have an F-150 and a 17-foot cargo trailer. And that's it. That's the whole circus. It fits the little bitty tent, and all of the pieces of ring curve were stacked up. The whole back bed of the F-150 was full of ring curve pieces, which is not a great use of space, as I've learned, but it was what we were. We put a tarp over it and we hurtled down the road. And getting through the in-between times, those first couple of years, that was the hardest part. You get the gig, and often those gigs, they don't give you advance on those gigs. They'll pay you after you've done, maybe incrementally over the event, but it wasn't until like year three where we landed a gig with in San Bernardino with the National Orange Show, which is a fair in San Bernardino that's part of an event center. And the event center does all these things like High Times. That's a big festival there. There's all these pot stuff shows out there and big Electric Daisy Carnival stuff. So the event center is like fat with cash, at least at the time when we got the event there. And the fair was always something that was, it had been going on for a long time, but they kept it going, I think, mostly because that's what they've always done. So anyways, this is the first time where they gave me an advance on the event. And I used that money with very crafty business financing to finance the tent that we have now, which right now is, I think, 4 payments away from being completely paid off, that's major for me. That's huge, man. So that's how we really started with the fairs. And once we got the tent, we had something. We did a couple of ticket events, one in Alabama at an indoor space. But we started then with this handful of fairs to, in between them, try and sell tickets at a place. And this way, if we totally fall on our asses and everything goes to hell, we still have the guarantee of the fair that's coming up just down the road. And in this way, we kind of steadied the ship over those early years. But by 2019, I remind you, the first event, one event in 2014, the whole year. In the second year, we had 2 fairs. So by 2019, just 5 years later, we had 25 venues that we played over 46 weeks. And they ranged from Florida to Tacoma. There's a lot of miles in between, and that is reflective not of my efforts, but rather that a group of people who believed in this too with me, and then we got closed down by a pandemic. But honestly, all of the things that happened before then, so much more challenging, and really set the stage for entering this very weird time, knowing that no matter how hard or bad it gets, we're going to find a way, and we're going to get back up. And it's so the kind of fear. I still had to do some crafty financial things as the COVID happened, you know, to make sure everything was solid and the company was on absolutely square footing, and we kept paying our bills. We didn't miss a single payment. So I can sing about the circus forever. And thank you all for continuing to listen to those people who are still on the line here.
No, I was just, before we started recording, we were talking about, you know, being the boss and how it's the greatest and the worst thing, because people either will love your decisions or hate them. And, you know, but I think one of the best things about your story, and also people that I admire, and what we're trying to do, is like that you've done it yourself. Like, we've washed the costumes every night. You know, we painted the bathrooms, like you drive the truck, you like set up the tent, you do it all. Right. And so when you ask others to help or do those things, it's not like you've never done it and you're like, I need you to do this. You know, it's like, I've been there. I do this. I'm there with you doing this. And as a leader and a boss, like, it's a much more powerful position to be in the sense of like, you've done it. You understand how hard it is. You're the performer. You're a part of the show. Like, you get it. Versus some producers that, you know, mainly more like Broadway and stuff that I know, they like just come in with money and then they're the producer, and, you know, and they lament about ticket sales and all this stuff. And you're like, but you've never had to do the hard stuff. And then when you make a bad decision, of course, everyone's really mad at you, because it's like, you just come in, you say the thing and you leave, versus like, you know, people in the circus for sure are doing it all. And I think like that's such a thing to be inspired by, and a wonderful thing. And it's, you know, really hard. But I think like that, and, you know, listening to your story too, it's like you've done it all. So it's cool.
But on the doing it all, sorry, just on the doing it all, because this is an interesting thing that happened to us, is casting people, and not everybody wants to do it all. Who one casts. So I'm also wondering if you can speak a little bit to how you find these people you've mentioned, your collaborators, who do have the right kind of mindset that Lindsay was just talking about as well.
Yeah, I recently worked with a casting director who has a lot, I mean, tremendous, like, decades of experience with Soleil, in fact. And it just turned out that, you know, after a couple of months working together, not a single person, and not because of a lack of best effort, and there were even a couple of maybe possibilities, but in the end, the actual showing up, the actual accepting the terms, the actual understanding of all of these things that are being asked, and agreeing to that, it means that my priorities here on the show, well, the top of it, of course, is the guest experience and the show's actually happening and running and getting down the road. To that end, it happens, at least this model happens, by us all pitching in and physically making it happen too. So vetting and speaking very clearly about what the responsibilities are, and finding people who, you know, you say, is someone, if I have someone who's like got a talent that is just absolutely extraordinary, and I put it against someone who has a talent that, I mean, this is all so subjective. And frankly, you know, you put this person or either one of them in front of an audience without the other one across America, who have largely zero experience to compare it to, and they will be absolutely blown away by either one of them, you know? So I would rate their willingness to work as perhaps more important than when it comes down to it. Of course, I'm aspiring to deliver a world-class circus experience. I think part of that is the environment that we have created with the tent and the music and the production. But it definitely, the purity of their act and their relating to the audience is hugely important. But their spirit, their their willingness to go and to be with it and for it, no matter how tough it gets, is the top of my list of priorities in finding people. So I want to like have on the casting
crew. Can get that? Like, sure. Is that how you're figuring that out? Like, how do you know?
Well, I mean, in the fullness of time, I mean, I haven't been doing what I'm doing now for 20 years, but I have been among the community and been collecting data, so to speak. And many of those little pieces of nuggets of things that I collected at one point, now they're something I see the importance of, or I can put in context. I recognize a quality that someone has. And so I sort of notice something, a word they might say makes me think, maybe they really don't want to be here. You know, this is also an important question. I'd say, hi there, Kitty. Cat just walked in front of the microphone. I say, this is one of the most important things we talk about. I say, okay, thank you for your time and being here and talking to me about this potential opportunity. But just let's, for a second, let's forget about this job. Can you tell me, like, what you love to do and what your dream is? If you could do the thing that you really love, like, what is that? And nothing is off the table. You know, some people want to just perform. Some people want to do other things. Some people want to produce. That's another thing. You know, if someone wants to be a producer and you're working with them on the show, I mean, understanding what everyone's getting out of the thing and what everyone wants is, I think, something very important to establish immediately. I think that we should raise each other up. And I think that there's more than enough opportunity for everyone out there. I'm not just saying that. I think excellent circus will buoy up all other circuses. It's the crappy, trashy stuff with people who don't really give a shit and they do things unsafely and they deliver subpar product. That's the stuff that negatively influences the market and all of our futures, you know, and it's really just one sea out there. You think that you could be just the big pilot ship that everyone follows, but all of those people that you work with, I mean, they go and work in other places. And if you, you've heard how I feel, at least conceptually, about treating people, I wish for us to raise each other up. So anyways, if someone wants to be a performer, if they have an act that they want to do, if they're taking a job where they're not doing the thing that they want to do, even if it's a hole that you really need filled in your production, be very wary about that, because they might take something because they're in a moment where they, I think there's good reason for a performer to, or anyone to take a job because it's going to be a great experience and that they're going to get value in XYZ out of it. Maybe they're not doing exactly the thing that they want to do yet. But just to be clear about that, to be very clear and understand that. And sometimes I think I've communicated myself, but I find out the other person I've been speaking to did not understand the thing that I said. So clarity, I mean, the way that I have agreements now, the language in the agreements, I started with something that, you know, was downloaded as a template from some whatever wackadoodle website, basic independent contractor thing. And now what it looks like is something that is completely different, because my particular operation has certain particular things about it. And you really only find out about what you need to communicate and ask of people once you've done it a few times and then discovered, oh shit, it's not going to work if we try it that way. Or, well, I actually need X, Y, and Z from people, not just what I'm saying here. So there have definitely been times when I've had to make concessions to someone because I didn't communicate things clearly. And I really hope now that, partly because I'm not wearing all of the hats now, you know, now we have a general manager. Now we have a front of house person that is communicating between, you know, the PR and the performers, someone who's a shoulder to cry on if need be, who's not me. That's a really important thing, that people get a chance to express themselves, because I think 99% of the issues I've ever had have occurred because of miscommunication or a lack of communication. One of my many flaws is that if I feel something or a confrontation, I tend to like just move on or ignore it. I think that being strong and just getting down the road and doing that thing is the thing to do. Let's suck it up, because that's just my instinct, whatever. When I feel I'm about to experience pain, I'm like, I get hard and I try and do that. But that's not a good way to lead. That's a terrible way to manage. really need to listen to people, and even if it's painful, in an appropriate moment, to the side, set a meeting, be on time for that meeting, show that you care, that person, that you want to hear what they have to say, and then find a way to make a decision of what will change to address that thing. And literally 99% of the time, if that it gets taken care of regularly, everything else seems to work itself out. We find a way. I mean, a team of people that wants to get something done, they can do anything. They can dig through feet of mud like we did getting in here when we got deluged with rain when we were setting up this tent. And here we are all cracking jokes and smiling through the sweat because we've already, in those moments when everything seemed good, but people were like, I don't understand this, or this thing is grating on me. We talked, we communicated. So that part is something I have had to learn the hard way, but it is truly one of the most important parts of getting the team on board and focused and happy.
One thing that we learned on the way of, we have a dance show too, that's not circus related at all, but hip hop contemporary dance. And it's younger performers, like some started when they were 17 and now are, you know, 21, 22. And one thing that we realized was like the company culture and making that very clear at the beginning to like have this culture that we all believe in to keep us all focused on. And when we did our circus show this summer, I think it was all older, older, like in their 30s, 20, you know, more experienced performers, and kind of we didn't really like think about that as the focus. And then we realized, oh, we need a company culture and talk in this area too. And, you know, so we're all on the same page of what's expected of each other and of us, you know. And I think, do you do that as a company, or is that something that you do you talk about it? Do you, or is it just something that you kind of put into play?
That's a great question. And much more so in the last couple of years with all these just different conversations that have been going on about the fabric of our society and how we treat each other. As independent contractors which is the ultimate relationship, I mean, business relationship I have with anyone who is performing or working here on the show, not really supposed to tell people how to do things, but we do have some company policies, policies about diversity and inclusion, about like personal hygiene, about communication, about harassment. That's very clear and laid out. So there's
what's
definitely
the personal
parameters
hygiene of, policy.
Oh yeah. Oh, fucking yes. Pardon my French. You can cut out that fucking or that one if you so desire, or you can leave it in there. The thing is that if someone shows up and there's stink, I mean, I'm all for us to embrace our individuality. But when you are imposing an odor on others, I do not think that that is fair. And yes, that is one of the things that I would ask people, please be shaven. Clean shaven, or if you have a beard, you wear the beard cleanly, no pieces of food in there that you have, you know, deodorized appropriately. I don't think that that's inappropriate. So, and I will stand up for that policy. I think that culture is something that is built, and it's something that is established day to day in the way that we interact and the level of communication, how that communication takes place, the care with which. I agree that having a mission statement is helpful to sort of have a star to guide you. I mean, for
that's
me-
it's more like, don't leave your costumes out. Make sure you get here time. You know what I mean? Like those-
Yes, those rules
that
are there.
You think are obvious. Sure. And then you're like, oh, wow. Like sure. Even with experienced performers, you still have to create the landscape of what's expected and how Absolutely. We all work together as a team, which I didn't, I guess, of course, duh. But then you're like, oh,
it seems
right,
knuck and futs that you have to explain this stuff that a 2-year-old should already know. Well, it's we all come from different sets of experiences. And so definitely try and I've had those same feelings sometimes. I'm like, why are these props over here? Why is there garbage just laying over here? taking the high road for the first couple of times. I haven't, and I don't want to have to get into a situation where there's some sort of demerit system or something like that. Those are the people I want to work with. I want to work with people who at least are willing to, if they don't know exactly how things are at first, of course, there's an opportunity to figure out. And with a small company like this, it's actually a lot easier to, this is the deal. And, you know, we all live in the same space. And also if we care about each other, maybe if someone's about to make an infraction, if you want to call it that, maybe our friend is there and say, hey, don't let me get this garbage for you. We're not supposed to do that, you know? And honestly, I really, the better we get at finding great people, the less that kind of stuff is necessary to go beyond just a, hey, guys, pick up your garbage. And that was the last time I ever had to mention that, you know? If you have to remind that person of those kinds of things too many times, it's not about, you know, I really don't ever want to get into confrontation with people. I would just rather, you know, start with short contracts. And and then, you know what I mean? And we work together and we really find out a little bit about each other. And maybe you don't like me, you know, maybe you don't like this place or stuff. And then you don't have to be stuck. And which I totally, there's plenty of things that I could do that might be irritating to another person or perhaps offensive. I certainly don't aim to be, but I am who I am. And so a shorter period to sort of get to know. And then once that is in place to extend beyond that. And, you know, in the beginning, I was only doing short gigs because that's all I had. So you really only get to see that sliver of people. And you really don't find out about what really is driving people until you get to spend some time with one another and have to go through some challenges where things aren't going exactly as we had planned. We have to overcome something. And that's when you really find out. So I want to be with the people who, when the chips are down, that they're there and going to fight and make it happen. Be there. I don't mean fight with each other. I mean, like, fight to be victorious and succeed. And so truly in an operation like a moving, traveling, tented show, that energy is truly superior in importance to the particular level of skill. And honestly, if you are pouring passion, you can be okay at a skill. But if you're pouring the same sort of passion that I'm talking about in terms of what you give to set up the tent and do those things into also developing your skill over a period of time, and we get, you know, 8-10 times a week to try it out and keep getting better, those are the people that keep pushing the envelope and keep improving and keep feeling that audience and getting better. And so those truly are the people that I want. And this is not a theater show where some exquisite artiste comes forth and presents their perfect work and then goes back to their, you know, air-conditioned room where they're, all of their M&Ms, the red M&Ms, are separated in their little bowl. This is circus, at least the way that I see it and I define it. And truly the experience that we give guests now in places across the country, not just in big metropolitan areas. In fact, the places we go are usually outside of the big cities, still filled with people who are exposed to top-notch entertainment. And so they could tell if they were seeing a crappy thing, but you touch their hearts by being there in their community. You showed up, you drove the miles to show up. And there aren't a lot of people out there that are willing to do all that stuff. So to the people who actually get out there and make it happen, are all the successes and all the wonders that their hearts could desire. They are all waiting there in this rich, amazing land. They are there, despite what you might see in your newsfeed. It's just waiting for you. So you just got to dig and keep digging and keep putting the tent up, keep getting down the road.
Well, you also are in an interesting position because you're a part of the show. It's like you and Keith Nelson and Jeff and Julie Jenkins are in these positions where you're the boss and you're also a performer on stage. So you have to have like that dual respect and confidence in everyone around you. But I was interested to know do you sing then in your circus? I'm assuming you have.
Yeah, sure. That's the thing that I wanted to do. So that'd be pretty stupid to throw that
right?
out.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. Is it original music or is it covers?
Yes. No, awesome. It's the music that individual artists bring for their acts, you know, in the context of a, call it plug and play world here where I have the production elements and we put this show together in a couple of days. you know, it can evolve and change as it goes along, but people bring their music. And so we use their music for their acts, but the production music is all original stuff. And, you know, it was recorded music, but recorded with live musicians. This is my friend, Larry, who I'm super proud of that music. Maybe we're going to lay down the vocals on top and actually get the album and have it on concession stuff. Like, we just haven't done that yet, I guess, and backlogs and priorities.
So one thing you said earlier was how, like, your dream needs a serial number in order to, like, actually know if you've made it. So seems like you've got the first few numbers on the serial number ticked. What things are on, like, your hopes and wishes for how Bernardo's Circus will grow and change over the next, I don't know, decade, let's say?
That's a generous and kind question posing to me. There's a new leaf in my life, which, of course, I have two new babies.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you so much. They are a blessing, and those who have children will know. And I'm overwhelmed. I am overwhelmed sometimes. Yes, physically, yes. We're not getting a lot of sleep, but I am. It's an overwhelming feeling. The kind of a joy, the very special kind of joy that has come from welcoming those people into my life. So I do think about a lot of things. The tour, I believe, for this company is going to continue to be a foundational element of what it does. But I also have dreamed a lot about having a place, a space where there were multiple uses, where the circus would have for a period of the year, a place where it would be up and running as an event. So it would be a property where commercial activity would take place. There might be other things like a food truck or a whiskey room. There might be rehearsal space for the circus. There might be a house for me and my little family. And finding out where that's going to be, that's something that keeps jangling inside of my head. I would love to think that in 5 years that's going to become a reality. In that, between now and then, as far as the tour is concerned, you know, we're staying 2 or 3 weeks in a venue. And I really do aim to have a tour that within those 5 years, I feel confident that there's going to be some limited variation in where we go, that it will be locked in, that those communities that we're serving are going to be the ones that we continue to serve moving forward. And we're just going to keep growing the people and the community that we touch as we're there. There may be another unit. I don't know. I definitely think that the intimacy of the experience that we deliver is something that is, I don't want to push that. I don't want to lose that. And what happens when a team of people actually makes it happen? You cannot force that kind of magic to happen. It is definitely requires some particular people to help guide and manage it. The fact is that I won't be the ringmaster forever. If I'm going to be successful at the dream, I have to set up systems where it can operate without me being there, where there is a different ringmaster I think the character of this Broadway style is our identity, and I love it. There may be some other project, but as far as the Bernardo Circus and this tour, I think that we're going to continue to grow the number of people we reach, and I'm going to keep doing the best I can at that. There's a lot of factors that I don't know exactly. What I do know is I'm going to keep getting down the road, and we're going to aim for 45 weeks a year. And I have that specific dream. I'm little seriously looking at real estate, but also I want it to be not just finding grass somewhere I mean, real estate. You can find grass in a whole lot of places. And maybe I want to put the circus in a place where you can find all kinds of that grass of all sorts. I want to be in a place where we can make a legacy impact on a community, where a community is at a place in their trajectory where we're not trying to shoehorn some grassroots project into a bloated with success place, because the cost of getting entry there is just, it doesn't make any sense. We need to find a place that is striving to grow, just like the little circus that could is striving to grow. And that message and how it would manifest physically in a space like that, it needs to be in line with the community around it. The community needs to find value in what we bring there and be accessible to us as a company that makes sense, that we wouldn't put in jeopardy anything about the touring portion of the company by outlaying resources to do this thing. So it'd be done by degrees over a period of time. But I really do believe when the water hits the stone, if given enough time, the water will win every single time. All those people that say that it's impossible, you can't do it. I really do believe stick-to-itiveness and staying truly in touch with what is important to you, your why. And if that thing that you're trying to do is at the core of your why and you keep feeding that, there is no question. It's just when and how long and how bad you want it will just determine how long you're willing to hold on to get it. That's really it. I'm not any smarter than you guys or anyone else. I think that one thing I've learned is that I have a tolerance for pain, and I love the circus. I love what it does. I love the way that it makes people happy. And also I love the way, as an entrepreneur now, I see the impact that it has when I place it next to other businesses. And all the work that we do and all the money and effort we spend to advertise and drive people to come to the circus, it brings affluence. It brings jobs that then over years, I mean, this is real. These are people have jobs because we put the circus here. And not only we give circus jobs at the circus, but we are making an impact in the other businesses that are nearby. And it's not inconsequential. The time that we are in St. Augustine for those weeks there, the impact that we make because we drive sales, one of the reasons why we went to St. Augustine is because they have a very developed tourism council. They had some grant money in the beginning, and for a couple of years, we were taking advantage of that grant money. It needed to be spent on advertising, and specifically on advertising that was more than 50 miles away, to people that were more than 50 miles away. And so, because the way that tourist-driven economies work is they have hotels there and attractions, and the hotels charge bed tax, and they use the money from the bed tax to invest in events and other things that will bring more people, that makes more bed tax, that grows the economy in that way. So if we could prove to the Tourism Development Council that we were bringing people from more than 50 miles away, we became very valuable to them. And we did that. We spent their money in the way that they asked, and then some. And we were able to show them with our ticket sales, the zip codes that people were coming from, proof that we had succeeded. And we also made deals with hotels and restaurants, and where the hotel and restaurant had a special 50% off voucher that we wouldn't give to anyone else. And so in this way, when they used those vouchers, we could see that we were people who stay in a hotel stay 2 or 3 days. That means they're not just coming to the circus. They're going to restaurants. They're going to attractions. They're spending money. So this little circus in St. Augustine, the most recent time we were there, made millions and millions and millions of dollars. I don't know exactly how many, but multi-millions of dollars of an impact, economic impact in that city over the time when we were there. We caused millions of dollars to be spent over our 3 weeks there on all kinds of things, just for these, because these people came. Maybe they were coming anyways. All right, you can't know that exactly. But I'll bet some of them we convinced to come because we were a cool circus. And maybe that was that extra little feather on the top of the camel's back that caused them to make that decision. So imagine all the feathers that fall across the country, the impact that makes, and then the jobs. It's when you know that what you have to say and your dream can positively impact the lives of other people in ways that the warm, fuzzy ways at the circus are definitely the reason why I started, the way that you feel and the way that you see someone's face light up. But to truly see that this operation, this little bitty thing that has grown just from people slogging in mud is now making impact like that, it is incredibly empowering. And I, like I said, I'm no smarter than anyone else. I just know that if I stick with it and I believe in the power of building a community for all kinds of reasons, not just to support you, but when you are helping and make, when you have a product or a service that makes an economic impact on other businesses. You truly contribute to creating jobs and lifting people out of poverty, out of sadness and depression. I mean, the list is, it's really extraordinary.
One thing
what
that
you have to say. Go ahead. Sorry.
That's all right. One thing that I've noticed, I think I noticed this before our conversation, but you've definitely, you've reaffirmed it for me, which is the case for your company. It's the case for Blaze Burgess, Flynn Creek Circus in California, which is the attitude of I'm going to figure out where to bring my show and where I can put it, and I'm going to put it up and I'm going to be responsible for that, is very counter to what I think has been more common in the last decade of saying, like, how do we convince presenters to say yes to let us put their show in their theater? And they only put one show, circus show, in their theater every year, and I'm competing against the five other companies who are also trying to pitch their one indoor show, and the one they pick is the one from Australia, not even the ones from America. So I think you have honestly landed on something that we've talked about on our podcast a lot for folks who listen to it, a model that is really sustainable, and it's essentially what we tried this summer. So I very much think, at least from an entrepreneurial point of view, you are on the very much the right track. One other thing, just going back again to having two kids under two, do you aspire to have a multi-generational circus family, or will you be happy for them to go do engineering and work somewhere else?
The website that we use now, VenardoCircus.com, still works, but people can't spell Venardo. So liveyourcircusdream.com, that's ours. And it's really, that was the thing I was putting on everything, the hashtag. We have a trademark on the hashtag, liveyourcircusdream. And I think that doing the thing that you want to do, the way that you want to do it, is the lesson that I hope the example of the world that myself and Marianne, that our dreams and the way that we have caused them to manifest would encourage those ladies as they grow to do the same for themselves. I have absolutely no mandate in my mind that they need to be doing something at the circus. I'm sure that they're going to be exposed to circus. So if they demonstrate a true desire that that's the thing they want to do, and I know we're going to want to expose them to all kinds of experiences, and there's going to be periods of life. And like I said, maybe we'll have this property, so they might have a more of a go to school, a school moment in life. Maybe they're homeschooling for part of the time. We're just going to make those decisions and make them the best that we can as we roll forward. But I want them to know that the world is not just open to them, but they have a responsibility, a personal responsibility, to make the most with their dreams and their passion of the time that they have on this earth. That this is not something that's given to everyone. I mean, you see William Shatner when he came off of the flying penis the other day, that Blue
Origin.
Origin.
The Amazon Bezos's rocket.
Yes, yeah. Which was fascinating and an amazing PR, I think, opportunity for all involved to stay in touch with the thing that makes you realize that you're not going to be here forever. And you're so lucky. It is such a miracle that we are here at all. And so when you see things are a miracle, then maybe you recognize that how fortunate and how grateful you must then be to just have the chance to give your all to something, to improve the life of others. And this is a fundamental part of what I've discovered following my dream. And I want very much, above any suggestion that my daughters need to follow in my footsteps, but rather that I hope that they follow in the example that me and their mom, Marianne, wish to set, aspire to set, which is to follow their dreams and to live authentically and give their best to make something of the time they're given.
Our son will be doing the... No, I'm just kidding. No, that's a nice...
Awesome.
That's a nice way to put it. I know it's crazy being a parent, isn't it?
Crazy? Crazy, yes. I don't know. I'm 45. So I'm a little bit older than some people who start out on this journey. And frankly, there were moments when I thought, am I going to be like, that means I'm going to be 70 when they're blah, 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 doing all this math in my head. And it really doesn't matter. it really doesn't matter. They're so beautiful. I can become easily overcome. And if I talk about my family, I even more easily. I'm so grateful actually now that we're at this place, and I'm not worried just about, you know, putting food on the table. There are larger, bigger things that I'm as passionately and I feel as much behind the eight ball about, but at least I'm not at that moment in life when I, you know, so I'm grateful now that we have a home and we, it happens to have wheels underneath it, but we're going to make it down the road. And so I hope that, I mean, no one I think knows me would really describe me as a particularly relaxed person. I think that I'm always moving. I have a hard time slowing down, in fact. So, I think that I'm so lucky. This is a blessing that came later, and actually in a way that I never anticipated. It had a lot to do because I found Marianne, and like things that are right. You know, it's not an effortful thing. Yes, it's work sometimes, but you know, sometimes I've definitely made the mistake of trying to shoehorn a relationship or stick with something because I felt compelled that if I just hung on a little longer, it's going to sort itself out. I think, I mean, one of my tragic flaws is that I hold on too long to sometimes the things. I have a hard time letting go when it's been passed already. You know, this thing is over. So one thing for sure now is I'm never letting go of these girls. And they've got me forever, forever and ever until the stars fall from the sky. So knowing that part is actually grounding in a way. And I want to be a grounding force. I want, like I said, to create systems and a world here that will go on after I'm not here. Or if I should happen to, I don't know, take a left when I should have taken a right, and the thing has to keep going. So,
well, I have a feeling you will very much reach your circus dreams, particularly the ones you've been talking about, you know, that are not so far from the distant future. But in the meantime, I do want to ask you the same final three questions that every single one of our guests get. The first one being, has there been a piece of advice, either really good or really bad, that somebody has told you and has stuck with you?
I think of people who have impacted my life. There have definitely been some nuggets garnered from a lot of different places, but the figure that looms largest in my mind is always going to be my father. And he never took a stand about politics in the house. We didn't talk about politics, even though he was the executive producer of the evening news. And we were all well aware and watching the news. You know, he quoted my great aunt, who was a big part of his life, and just love one another. And but he did also say that, and it was stealing from Shakespeare, to thine own self be true. Being a kid and a wiry, thick glasses kid, and I got picked on, and as a young person, I was a victim. I felt like a victim. I was sad a lot of the time. I felt that these kids didn't like me and I didn't understand why. And there may have been some truth that there's some shitty kids at this Catholic school that I grew up in. Catholic school is always the worst, huh? you know, a lot of it was my own perception at the time. Finding the courage to truly be okay in your skin, to recognize the things that make you different from other people, is actually the thing that makes you capable of a kind of magic no one else can create. And there's 8 billion people in the world. Maybe half of them hate you. Okay. But the other half, they love you just as you are. And if you just be who you are, or the best version that you're capable of at each stage as you progress, you will keep attracting those people who know you, or who know that heart in you exists and loves it already. Spending so much time worrying about convincing the people that don't get you is a big mistake and a waste of time.
Great.
Terrible waste of time.
I hope everybody takes that,
yes,
to heart.
I agree. I agree. To thine own self be true. Or as Dr. Seuss said, I was do what you something and say what you feel. Those who mind don't matter. Those who matter don't mind.
Yes, you can't go wrong, Dr. Seuss. With a Seuss quote, for sure. But maybe now you can't, but I don't know. Not that one. This is a good question. Is there a book, a movie, a painting, a show, a piece of art that really has moved you that you would recommend somebody check out?
Boy, these are some big questions. I think of the favorites and I think of like, it's like the days of the week or the months of the year, because it, what you hear or what you're seeking is different depending on where you are and what's going on around you. I loved Sunday in the Park with George. It's one of my favorite musicals ever. About the artist experience. I know, a book, I love biographies. I've listened to the biography by Ron Chernow of Alexander Hamilton. Of course, I got hooked about on the subject because of the musical. And actually, my life is so not about musicals these days. I mean, the show is kind of a musical, but I feel like I spent so much time focusing on that in college, and now it's moving a different direction. But that man is an extraordinary story. And an American story, an immigrant bastard. I said bastard not to like as a derogatory term, but this is a term that means that he was born and he didn't really have parents that
and
were
also
in wedlock.
Like son of a whore.
Just to be clear. Yes. Yeah, well, then good. I just want to be clear. This bastard, I didn't want to throw it around like I was like putting
That's
him
like
down.
That's like the opening but, line of the first
yes,
song.
Yes, and he's flawed. He's flawed and he has... I'm sure there's all kinds of other things. You know, all of us are human and we have bad decisions. Some of them come to light. Some of them stay dark and are unknown about forever. You know, we are the ones who go to the grave with them. But the different shades and different challenges, you know, he's a figure that I've absolutely been inspired by. And also the story of Walt Disney, it was something I needed to hear. So whatever the union workers might feel about him, that's another matter, but I like to listen to the entirety of a story. And if someone was all one color, it's uninteresting because life is not one color. So trying to get some context there. So now that I've given you 18 volumes of information for your one simple question, that is very much in line with Kevin Venardos's verbosity. So please, what is question number three, Josh?
Okay, well, our final question is, who do you think we should have on our podcast?
Oh boy, that's a great question. Have you had did you have Chris on yet?
Lashua?
Yeah,
Chris Lashua. Yeah. Yeah. All right. We love Chris. I got to know him during the pandemic, so that's why I mentioned that. Who are making new things.
Could be anybody. It could be anybody in the circus. It doesn't have to be a producer or director, it could be an artist, but we'll take anybody who you think's interesting.
The older people, I don't know if you're interested in that, or old circus and what they think of how the world works now, you know? I don't know. A weird character would be a guy named Alex Petrov, who I worked with as a tent master. He came across as part of a teeter board act, like, I don't know, must be 40-something years ago. His father was a troop leader for a Bulgarian teeter board act. And his father ended up being a huge relationship, hugely important relationship to Irvinfeld and later Kenneth Fell with the Ringling Show. But Alex, his son, and that's the one that I know, and the one that I would suggest interview. He is hard as nails. He's the guy who taught me how to put up my tent for the first time. He now has shifted after working for Ringling for 35 years in the same exact role. He's going to be like a truck driver talking to a truck driver. And yet he has a heart for the circus. He loves the circus. He loves animals too. And he's heartbroken. So just, I think that it'd be a really, really interesting if he's down with it, and he might be, just to how he feels about, I mean, one of the cool parts of, you know, just to share with you, when Ringling, you know, ended and he lost his job, like all the other people, he had grown up literally his entire life from the time that he ever knew anything. He did have some experiences in Europe prior, but 30 years and touring on tour for 30 years, like straight ahead. It's fucked up, that shit. So he actually took three ponies that were on Ringling at the time, and he's not a guy of means, it would have been impossible. I guess if you were a good investor and for 30 years, you might have been able to do something, but that's was not part of the skill set, I don't think, presented to him initially. So he took these three ponies, and when he's been with work or without work, and it's been a financial hardship, he has provided a stable space for these three ponies. And he goes and he drives and he feeds them all the time. Whenever he's been out of town for a gig, he has someone that he pays to go and take care of him. So these three ponies are alive and well, and sometimes working. Like, they went up to a Circus World this summer. I think the ponies worked there. But that is just one example of him and his character. He got very upset with me when we said that we're an animal-free circus. I tried not to blast that as like a headline in the beginning. But honestly, it's the first thing that anyone wants to know who wants to see a circus. So I'm like, I want to just, this is what we are. So the people, you love us, you hate us, got haters, go ahead and talk. You're going to make the lovers love us even more and buy more tickets.
You got to so use line, like when someone asks you animal circus, you go only human animals.
Yes, that's definitely, I've taken that tack, but just literally in terms of the fractional amount of time that a person makes a decision, you're seeing the way ad sets perform online and the bottom line. The bottom line is I want to provide a sustainable future for people. We need to sell tickets to that. So I take the emotion out of the equation. I could go on and not add forever about the circus, but Alex is an interesting guy. Maybe he would talk to you. And I think that would be a highly contrasting person from perhaps the pantheon you have yet interviewed. So there's my suggestion.
Yeah, I love that.
Thanks, Kevin. Well, Petrov, you know when we post it, and good luck with the rest of your tour.
Thank you, guys. Cheers.
Bye.
Good day to you.
And that was our interview with Kevin Vernardos.
If you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com.
And don't forget, you only have 3 more weeks to catch Beyond Babel off-Broadway in New York City. Use code PODCAST at checkout for a sneaky little discount.
Have a good week.